you get up on your little 21-inch screen and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. What do you think the Russians talk about in their councils of state? Karl Marx? They get out their linear programming charts, statistical decision theories, min-max solutions, and compute the price-cost probabilities of their transactions and investments just like we do.
Hello, everybody. It's your Chapo for the week. It's me, Will Meneker, joined by Matt Chrisman, and standing in for Felix, who is currently blowing this month's Patreon at the craps tables of Atlantic City, is Brendan James. How are you guys doing?
Surviving.
I'm fine.
So I'm pretty excited for this week's show. I'm kind of thrilled. I'm super hyped that we get to bring you this. But this week's show is an interview we did with the filmmaker Adam Curtis. It was a long conversation. It was fascinating and thrilling to me because I'm a big fan of his work. But I figure maybe some of you aren't familiar with Adam Curtis. So before we play the interview, I don't know, how would you guys describe him? He's a British documentary filmmaker whose films are I think, fascinating, and I don't know, I think they really fit in with the sort of Chapo vision of the world.
Well, loyal listeners will know that we did a gentle parody, a loving parody of Adam Curtis, the Adam Curtis-style narration a couple episodes ago for the show.
Yes. Imitation is the highest form of flattery. We spent most of the interview talking about his most recent movie, which is called Hypernormalization. And it's like it's just a sprawling documentary. It's like almost it's like I think it's like 3 hours long. There's all these digressions, and basically what it is like a history of the last 40 years or so that's kind of seen through the lens of I think like a lot of the themes that he's developed in his previous work.
Yeah, it's basically about how like the neoliberal state has sort of obliterated society while at the same time frantically trying to create systems for managing the very thing that it's destroying.
Yeah, his movies are very bleak, to say the least. But and I think a major theme of them, and it's something we talk about with him, is the failure of not just liberals but also the left to really change the world for the better or at all, really, over the last, you know, half of the 20th century and present as well. It's sort of a lot of it is tough medicine, to be honest, but I think it's very important and fascinating to think about, nonetheless. And I think it's something that we should all probably have to come to terms with. So maybe some of the things he says you won't agree with, I don't know, but I think it's medicine that we all need to take.
It's good, but it's not as good as his documentary about Brandon Wardell, Hype Beast Normalization. I'm still glad that I know what that means now. I didn't know before we had him on. And now I say it every day to anyone I see under the age of 25. And hey, kids, are y'all hype beasts? And they know I'm cool.
I just want to point out that during this interview, Adam talks about the film Stalker and The Zone, which is an idea that we named our post-election show after. And he's describing what the metaphor means, and he says, I suppose if I wanted to be a little bit more on the nose about it, a little bit more plonky about it, I would have simply said, We live in the zone now. Which is exactly what we had named our post-election
episode. That's right, bitches.
Episode.
We're the plunkier Adam Curtis.
Yeah.
The plunkier Adam Curtis.
We're not
that stuff's too artistic and sort of subtle, come here. We'll just scream it into your fucking ears. You don't have to worry about anything being over your head.
Well, I guess, everybody should go watch Hypernormalization. You can find it online, I'm sure. But, we're in a moment now where everyone is, like, asking themselves, like, how we got to this point, you know, with Donald Trump being our president. And
hell yeah, bitch.
Probably more than anything, I would say, like, this movie, like I said, it's very digressive. It's very, it covers a lot of stuff. There's a lot of threads in it. But, like, overall, the feeling that this movie evokes and the sort of what it lays out, I think does a better job of kind of describing how we got to this point than almost anything else I've seen recently.
Especially since the movie was finished before the election.
Oh, yeah.
So he brings up the Trump campaign and he sort of points to it as like, the culmination of these trends. But because it's still in the air, it's just sort of left there to dangle. But when you watch that movie, with the hindsight of having seen the election happen, you're like, okay, really nothing else could have happened. Like, everything he's talking about in that movie, Trump's election is the only thing that makes sense. So as, like, crazy as it feels to watch Trump assume the presidency, when you look at the way that things have evolved and the way that culture and economics and the spectacle of media have played out, really there was no other thing that could have happened. And I think we all kind of knew that. And even on the show, we would kind of talk around like this, like, dark knowledge that we felt like the only thing that made sense was Trump winning, even back during the primaries. But we couldn't really accept that we were at that point yet. I think we all thought, yeah, sure, a few cycles from now, you know, but not yet. We're not there yet. And I think things are moving a lot faster than even we could get our heads around. In wrestling terms, we've gone from a work to a worked shoot.
Well, who knows? Again, without further ado, let's just get to this interview. It was a thrill for me to do it. I really enjoyed it. It's one of my favorite things that we've done on the run of the show yet. Adam Curtis, everybody. Let's roll that interview. I guess for people who haven't seen the movie yet, I guess if I could describe it, you cover the last 40 years or so, and there's a lot of fascinating threads that you tease out. But if there's an overarching theme, I guess it's that the world we're living in now is one where the line between fantasy and reality, between politics and entertainment, is now been almost thoroughly erased. And we're all existing in these kind of synthetic realities. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
I would say semi-synthetic reality. But yes, that's a reasonable assessment. I mean, what I was trying to argue in that film, by going back into the past and coming back to the present, was to show how so many different groups in society, faced by growing complexities, retreated from trying to deal with those complexities and, for different reasons, invented a simplified version of the world, which increasingly became detached from reality. And what I was trying to argue is this wasn't just the politicians. I mean, they did do that, and they did it to hang on to power. And they created fictions and they lied in order to hold on to that power. But we, liberals, ordinary people, right-wing people, also retreated. We're also, what's the word, complicit in this. And I think that was one of the things I was trying to say in the film, is we're all living in a rather strange, it's not really fantasy world, it's a world that we all know in the back of our heads, which that it feels slightly odd, slightly unreal, and sometimes downright fake. But because there isn't anything else, we just sort of accept it. And I was trying to get at that. I was trying to bring that feeling that people have in the back of their minds forward and then say, I'm going to try and explain why we feel like this.
Do you think it's a kind of a sense of helplessness?
No, I think it's a feeling that, I mean, the why I called it hypernormalization, it's a phrase I borrowed from a Russian writer who was writing about what it was like in the Soviet Union in the 1980s. As when we look back now, we can see that the Soviet Union was collapsing. And he argued that people living in the Soviet Union at that time knew that those in power didn't know what was happening, knew that those managing the plants were corrupt and greedy and stealing from it, knew that actually the whole system was based on lies and fakery. But because there was nothing else, that was all there is, they just accepted it as normal. And he coined the phrase hypernormalization to describe this sort of slightly... It's not helplessness. It's a sort of enervated state. You know that it's not quite right. But because you haven't got anything else to compare it with, a sort of benchmark, as you were, to say, that, look, this is real and this is fake, because you haven't got that, you just sort of feel slightly jittery. It's like, you know those moments in sci-fi movies where suddenly a bit of reality breaks through and then goes back again, like that. It's sort of like that. And I was trying to explain why there was that enervated feeling at the moment.
Well, I'm glad you brought up science fiction and movies, because one of the metaphors that you reach for from science fiction is you talk about the Strugatsky brothers and their book Roadside Picnic, which was then made into the film Stalker.
Yes, that's right.
Could you explain the metaphor of the zone and how that kind of describes the state that you're talking about?
Well, again, this is about the Soviet Union. The Strugatsky brothers were two science fiction writers who, really from the 1960s, grabbed the imagination of young Russian, Soviet people. Well, they were Russian people in the Soviet Union. And what they did is, in a way, they became the closest to express the disenchantment, because there was no political opposition, because everything was sort of normal, but it felt odd. What the Strugatskys did was somehow find a way of explaining that, or bringing that forward into the imagination through science fiction stories. And they wrote this book, which I think is wonderful. And actually, and this is a terrible thing to say to cineasts, but I think it's sort of better than the film. They wrote this book called Roadside Picnic, where it's a world like ours, but somehow set in the future. And except in the middle of it, there's this area called the Zone, which is as if someone from an alien force had come once upon a time, visited, and now gone. But if you go into the Zone, it's very strange. Things change. Reality sort of morphs. Shadows go the wrong way. You're never quite sure which direction you're going in, and you can never be sure what's real and what's not real. And what the Strugatskys, I think, were trying to do with that book was say, this is what the Soviet Union has become. It's become a sort of weird, strange place that you know a lot of things are unreal, a lot of things are fake, and a lot of things are very odd and sort of slightly out of phase. But because there's nothing else around you, you just accept it. You're in the zone. And that's what I meant. It's normal, but it's hyper-normal because it's not quite real. And that's the zone we're in. And what I was trying to argue in the film, I'm not trying to say that we're like the Soviet Union in any way, but what we do share is a feeling that we're at the end of something, because so much around us, I mean, we know this ourselves, is you know that there are lots of people who do bad things. Bankers who have, it's been clear that they have done really bad things, but practically no one is prosecuted. There are sort of politicians lie to us, and we know that they're lying, and they know that we know that they're lying, but then nothing happens. It's this sense that we know that it's all a bit odd, but then nothing happens as a result of it. So we accept it as normal, but we know it's wrong. And that's what I was trying to get at. And that's sort of what the zone is about. And if I was going to be what we British call plonky and sort of make my film a little, what I was trying to say, a little more obvious, we're sort of in the zone now. We know that it's all a bit unreal, but we can't see anything else. So we're stuck within it. And I mean, a lot of the politicians, the mood that is leading to things like Brexit and Trump come from that sense of dissatisfaction, of sort of an enervated state of jitteriness, that we know it's wrong, but we haven't got anything else that we know is real to grab onto and say, we want that. So we grab for the latest, for the closest bit of, I don't know, vaudeville that we find in order to push it a bit.
Another sort of semi-real zone that you discuss in this movie is cyberspace, and you just talk about another science fiction writer, the American William Gibson, who coined that term. And again, it's this effect of prescience in science fiction to describe a world that we're now living in. Could you talk a little bit about William Gibson's view of cyberspace?
Yeah, Gibson's really, I mean, you're right. Science, if you look at the period we've lived through in the last 30, 40 years, the left sort of collapsed, but it's through culture that you get critiques. And above all, I mean, it may be because I like science fiction, but I do think science fiction has played quite a big role in this in all sorts of ways. And I do think Gibson's really important because Gibson comes up, and I think it's in 1984, he writes the series of books. The Sprawl Trilogy, they're called. They're set within this world of the Sprawl, a world of the future. In that world, people can, I suppose it is a bit like going into the zone again. People can actually jack in, as he calls it, he calls it cyberspace. He invents that term. And it's the world of connected computers. He's seen at that point, this is 1984, that you can conceptualize in the imagination the world of interconnected computers, of networks, as another world. And he calls it as another space. And he calls it cyberspace. And his heroes, or, you know, anti-heroes, go into that world. What's really interesting about the way what Gibson does, which is why I think he's really important, is that he was writing in the midst of the Reagan era, when what was happening was government and the power of government to shape the world was receding, and the power of giant corporations, and above all of finance, was rising up to replace them. And Gibson's vision in those books is quite a dark one. It's that what he describes as cyberspace is a world where politics, law, none of that plays any role. What you do is you move through these giant blocks of what he calls them ice. They're blocks of information which are secured by the most terrifying protection systems, but you can jack into them if you're clever enough. But if you're not quick enough, your mind will get mangled.
They'll literally melt your brain.
They literally melt your brain. And some, you know, some of these people who go into cyberspace die. And if you look back, what Gibson was trying to do, it was a metaphor for that time. He was saying, look, there is this other world out there, but actually it's the zone we're beginning to live in now, where these giant corporations are ignoring the old systems of power and creating their new systems. He was way ahead of his time. What I point out to the film is that actually his vision didn't last very long, and a bunch of ex-acid freaks. So,
yeah, you talk about these sort of California technological utopians who created their own vision of cyberspace as a world free from power and hierarchy, where anyone could be anything and we would all be free online.
They saw in it a place where they could actually have their idea of a counterculture become true. So what Gibson described as an alternative space where giant corporations were actually freeing themselves from government power and controlling people through ruthless, raw power of their own, the aging hippies took it, literally turned it round. Their idea of cyberspace, and you see this from the late 80s, really rising up in the early 90s, they turn it into their vision of where the counterculture could actually flourish. It could flourish in cyberspace, free of governments, free of control by elites. And they invent this sort of, I don't know, a utopian idea of a new kind of democracy where no one is in charge and everyone can somehow connect together through feedback in the network systems and together create a new kind of stable world. It's the very opposite of what Gibson had described. And it's an absolutely fascinating shift. And it is this thing that idea of individualism that the hippies brought in the 1960s and then sort of fell on its knees in the 70s, came back in the 80s as a place that the left could retreat to in the face of people like Reagan and Margaret Thatcher here in Britain. As the right took control of real politics, the left saw in cyberspace a sort of, how would you describe it? It's not a fantasy world. It's a sort of another world to retreat to, where they could actually have their idea of a non-elitist society. And I think that's where a lot of the left got trapped.
Trapped in this idea of sort of cultural power over real political power?
Trapped in a world which was a sort of fictional version of a sort of a simplified version of democracy. Because what really rose up out of that post-hippie idea of cyberspace was this idea that through the connection of computers on networks, you could have a system where all individuals could connect with each other through feedback. No one would be in charge. And somehow out of that would come a sort of new stability. They look to ecosystems as well, as a, in nature as a model. And out of that would come this stability, and there would be no one in charge. It was, I tell you what it was, it was a picture of a world without power. Yeah?
Mm.
If you look back at the 1980s, politicians were reeling in the face of the rise, above all of finance, because finance said, no, we can do it for you. And it was tough, and it was, and there were tough people around Reagan and behind Mrs. Thatcher, and the left could not deal with it. So they what they did is they invented this idea, the utopian idea of a sort of a space outside time where there was no power. And actually, if you talk to the liberals and the left these days, the one thing they never talk about is power. Have you noticed this? It's really interesting. At a time when actually, by every measure, inequalities of life span, of opportunity, of wealth have gone up massively, and raw power has shown itself again and again and again over the last 30 years. The left, between us, never talk about power. I mean, it's almost left to Game of Thrones. No one else does. They just don't. And it's all about how, as individuals, we can just sort of move away from these horrible, powerful people and connect through feedback in a sort of flat, level playing field with no hierarchies. And somehow out of that, stability will come. And I'm afraid this is where I think the Occupy movement in the, when was it, 2011 onwards?
Yeah.
They borrowed many of their ideas of a new kind of society from that cyberspace utopianism. I don't know if you ever went to any of their meetings.
I did. I went to Zuccotti Park several times. I guess I wasn't really active in the movement, so to say, but I did go there. And I guess the thing I found was this sort of call and response, this kind of horizontal organizing. It was novel, but I was just thinking to myself, this would be a nightmare to get anything done with.
Well, I mean, I went there. I'm a journalist. I went there to observe. I was sympathetic because I really thought for once the left had captured the imagination of people who would not normally join into these things. And they had a fantastic slogan, 99% and 1%. They had a great win behind them. And I went to these meetings and I just couldn't believe it, because it was all about, again, trying to create a world, this time for real, sitting around in circles where there was no power. And if anyone demonstrated any power, like, I think we should do this, a bit of leadership, they were sort of, looked at very badly, as if they'd done something really naughty. If you want to change the world, you have to confront the entrenched power.
Well, one group that absolutely did demonstrate power was the New York City Police Department. Do you think that that exercise of power played any role in the failure of Occupy Wall Street?
I think that came from, I mean, I don't know enough about Occupy Wall Street. I think that came late. I think the real failure of all these movements in the last 10-15 years has been because they have failed to actually confront the real issue, which is, how do you inspire two things? How do you inspire a group of individuals to come together to actually use their collective power to confront entrenched power? And I'm afraid the police men and women of the New York Police Department are not really the power we're talking about. What we're talking about is, how do you get hold of, I don't know, those who run finance and actually make them work, shape finance in the interests of everyone, not just a small group of people who then let it use it corruptly, as it was shown in 2008. It's tragic. I mean, I think, as I say, if I'd been running Occupy, I'd have sacked them. come on. It was just such a great moment. I remember thinking, oh, this is okay. They've done it now. This is good, because they've broken the barrier of what? Of acceptability amongst so many middle-class people who were beginning to feel uncertain and alone. They've got through, and they will grab their imagination somehow. And instead of grabbing their imagination, they turn people's imaginations away by sitting around in circles, pretending that there was no such thing as power. Now, power is extraordinary. It's both terrifying, but it's also thrilling. And out of it come extraordinary stories and narratives. I mean, the whole of human history is full of stories about power, right? It grabs people's imagination. And the way you're going to change the world is by somehow dramatizing the power that shapes your world. And if I could bring this egotistically and ruthlessly back to myself, the film I
please do
is actually dramatize where power now has shifted. Yeah,
yeah.
So many of us, the left, the liberals, and politicians, have retreated into a simplified world. We haven't seen how power has shifted to all kinds of new systems of management and control that actually shape our lives. And if you're going to make the world a better place, you're going to have to A, see them, bring them into focus, and B, deal with them. And that involves actually confronting the issues of power on every level, including the way you organize political movements.
If I could switch slightly and go back to another section of your movie that I have to ask you about, because for me, it was sort of the highlight of the whole 3.5-hour movie. It goes back to popular culture and entertainment. And about halfway through this movie, you have a montage of late 90s mega disaster movies where all of these movies happened over the course of about 5 to 7 years. I remember seeing almost all of them in the movie theater. And when you put them all together, it really is frightening and hilarious, because what they all show is New York City being destroyed over and over and over again in largely the same way, with skyscrapers and even the Twin Towers collapsing into themselves or being knocked over. Could you talk a little bit about that montage and what the sort of political and cultural forces you think that this repeated trope in all of these pre-9/11 movies were channeling or anticipating?
I think what they were channeling was the rise of a dark pessimism amongst in a society that once used to be progressive and have hope for the future. And one of the things I was trying to trace in the whole film was the way so many politicians, but we ourselves, had retreated into a pessimistic view of the world. And I think the reason for that was that somewhere in the late 1980s, politicians gave up having a picture of a better future. It happened for all sorts of reasons. It happened because of economic crises. It happened also because of the rise of individuals. It's very difficult to have one uniting vision when everyone wants to be an individual. But what replaced the idea? The old idea of going to build a better world, and you and me give the politicians a vote, as that died away, what politicians turned to, in order to keep power and keep their prestige in society, they turned to the idea of risk. And I do think risk is one of the really underlying things that hasn't been examined in our society. Instead of saying, I'm going to take you to another world, which is better, what they said is there are dark and terrifying things out there in the future coming towards us, like sort of dark, strange, hungry animals.
In these films, it's an asteroid, it's a comet, it's Godzilla, it's a monster.
But those films are a sort of cultural reflection of that. I think it's really deeper than that. Is you see it in the way politicians warn you about how you should eat, how all the dangers. It's all about dangers in the future. Yeah. Now, the trouble with that, if you're going to base your system of power not on imagining good worlds, better worlds in the future, but imagining dark worlds, the things that might happen that I'm going to protect you from, then actually, if you think about it, you have to imagine the worst, because your imagination begins to run out of control. And I think what happens in the early 90s is you begin to see it reflected in the culture.
If these disaster movies were channeling the sort of pessimism of the late 90s, our popular culture now has certainly grown even more dark.
Yes, because there is no future. I mean, there is none. But the real problem, this is really quite an interesting subject, is if you imagine in the 90s the worst that might happen, right? And then it's 2001, the worst does happen, yeah?
Yeah.
It seems to confirm that dark pessimism that had already been built into the system. So everything, the dark imaginings, run out of control. And I made a series called The Power of Nightmares in 2004, where I tried to argue that the dark imaginings had run completely out of control. It wasn't that there wasn't a serious terrorist threat. Of course there is. But the idea that Al-Qaeda was an apocalyptic network with cells hidden everywhere, and had the capacity and the power to bring down Western civilizations to its knees, which, let us not forget, is exactly what my colleagues in the BBC and your journalists in America were saying. It was just ridiculous. It was something that had really run out of control. It sort of then died away, but it's come back with a vengeance now. I don't quite know why, but it is astonishing. Have you noticed that there are no politicians, no elites, no scientists, no think tank people, no economists who have any vision of the future other than a one going, it's going
to
be really fun.
I don't know. Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. That's slightly optimistic.
No, that is absolutely true. Silicon Valley is the last vestige of a sort of optimism, isn't it?
Oh, that's the most frightening thing you said.
Yeah, that's fucking terrifying.
But their political basis for that is a sort of weird utopian individualism, a sort of Ayn Randian thing. You know that guy Peter Thiel? He wants to create a whole country off the coast of America that doesn't have any government.
Yes. So there is this, and drink the blood of young people also.
Peter Thiel doesn't want to die. That's pretty optimistic.
This is the whole problem. Actually, no. To be fair to my theory of the darkness closing in, Silicon Valley, the baby boomers and the sub baby boomers who sort of have risen up and dominate Silicon Valley, because they're arch individualists and they don't believe in anything beyond themselves, the one thing they cannot deal with is their own mortality. No, it really is. You know that novelist Ayn Rand?
Sure.
They'd love what she thought. Wasn't she frightened of death? And she went in a, I can't do the German accent, but she said, I'm not frightened of death. I won't die. And the journalist went, what? What do you mean? And she said, it's not I won't die. The world will die. And what she meant by that was the fact that if you are a total individualistic, narcissistic person, the world is inside your head. There is nothing else. And she's absolutely right. From that point of view, when you die, the whole world dies because you are the center of the world. Don't stop. And I would argue that the desperate attempt to, what's the word? It's a sort of cryogenic thing they've got, isn't it? To keep themselves from dying is part of that. It's this desperate attempt because there is nothing beyond them. And this is the tragedy. I mean, I'm going back to the idea why politics doesn't have a vision of the future, is if you live in a world of individuals where everyone is encouraged to believe that what they feel and what they want and what they desire is the center of the world, which is pretty much, I believe, the ideology of our time, then it's very difficult to conceive of anything beyond your own death. And it's very difficult now. And I think that's one of the things that the left has real problems with, is how do you herd a bunch of narcissistic piglets who want to have their own death? Yeah? I mean, it sounds silly, but it's sort of true. That's why politicians find it very difficult to create collective movements, because everyone is running squealing, following their own desires. And the one people that who can manage it are social media, like Facebook, because you all believe that you are a little piglet doing exactly what you want, when in fact the algorithms are actually saying, hang on, all those piglets look exactly alike and we can tell them what to do. Yet the piglets feel that they are still individuals, which is just brilliant. They've squared the circle in a way that politicians can't.
Well, Adam, one of the funny things that's happened in the last month or so since the election of Donald Trump has been this panic in the liberal media about fake news and the spread of fake stories on social media networks, especially Facebook, as somehow altering the outcome of what otherwise would have been a different election. And to me, it seems like something out of one of your movies. This weird kind of meta panic about fake news by fake news people.
Well, I mean, there's been lots of fake news way before this. I mean, what was weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah,
right.
I have real problems with this. My real problem with this is it's so patronizing to those who voted for Donald Trump, because basically what it's saying is if only they'd been told the real things, then of course they wouldn't. But they're stupid people, and they didn't really know what was going on because they can't tell the difference between truth and reality, whereas, of course, we can. Well, no, you can't, because you didn't see the man. I'm sorry, I'm fed up with this amongst... there's a certain bunch of liberals who just go, oh my God, the stupids are now in control. No, they're not. You're stupid. You lost the election. Of course, the point about the internet is that it does have a load of weird stuff on it. Yes? It does.
It's the best thing about it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, my vision of the internet is that it's rapidly becoming like, do you remember all those 1980s movies set in decaying city centers, like Escape from New York and things like
RoboCop.
That?
RoboCop.
Yeah.
RoboCop and all those sort of things. And there are always weird, mad people in sort of post-goth outfits in decaying factories. There's a lot of firepower. And it's just, it's exciting and fun and weird and frightening. And everyone else has moved to the suburbs. And my view of the internet is that that's exactly what it's about to become. It's going to become this strange swamp that you go into where everyone sensible has left. and they're reading their books. But if you really want to go and have fun, you go into this world where you don't know what is true and what is true. Can I just say, no, I do think that the liberals who go on about post-truth at the moment have got to look back at 2003 and say that was all post-truth, the whole thing.
And they all went along with that too at the time.
And most of them, including those who sort of didn't like the invasion, believed it. Yeah?
Yeah.
That's post-truth, and that is so much more important. So to squeak about post-truth at this stage without seeing the much more important roots of how politicians lied to them again and again and again over the last 6 or 7 years is, I don't know, it's again an example of the left retreating into a simplified world. They go, oh, it's all not really real, so therefore Donald Trump's not really real. No, it's not like that. Donald Trump and the dissatisfaction that his the votes for him come from things like 2003. It's not because they read some little fake news on some news feed on Facebook. It's because in 2003 and then in 2008 with the banks, the politicians lied and failed to do anything. That led to a people turning away from politicians and not trusting them, and they deserve it.
Adam, if you do your next movie, I don't know if you're working on anything, but just a documentary about Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign would include all of these themes magnificently.
It would be the most comprehensive look at the psychosis of our time.
I mean, so if I take you, what you're saying is you distrust these, you think the liberals are refusing to face up to why they lost. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. They totally succumb to all these fantasies. They're wrapped around in blaming the Russians or blaming the FBI or the America's innate racism. They can't face the essential disconnect between the Democratic Party and the American electorate.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I got into trouble here with so-called liberal friends where I just say, look, people like Donald Trump and Brexit. Well, I should just take Donald Trump. Donald Trump is what in learned circles is called a comedic character. He is a giant vaudeville distorted figure who is showing you, the liberals, what kind of society you have created. And for the last 30 years, you have been living a lovely life, but out there is something else, and you have ignored it completely and utterly, and you have lied to it, and you have let it down. Weapons of mass destruction did have a big effect in my country, and I'm sure it did in yours. It went quite deep. Liberals, they really hate it. They cannot deal with it, because what it's showing is you have created a society in which you don't actually believe in anything any longer. This is more sort of what I was trying to say gently in hypernormalization, is the problem with the liberals, and that the whole middle, that genteel middle class, it's not just liberals, is they don't actually believe in anything any longer. And that's the real problem. And there's a guy I quote at the end of hypernormalization, who is a guy called Abu Musab al-Suri, the Syrian. He's a terrorist, you journalists would call it mastermind, but he's a terrorist from Syria, whose writings in the last 5 or 6 years have inspired many of what are called the lone wolf attacks in Europe. And what al-Suri says is, look, don't bother with politicians because they don't have any moral authority any longer. Don't have a big organization because you'll just get bombed to shit by America, which is what happened to bin Laden. He's very critical of bin Laden's organization in Afghanistan. And what you do is you go for the liberal middle classes. And the reason is, he says in this very long book, is they don't believe in anything any longer. so they will, you can frighten them. And I think that's where we are at the moment. And if I could come back to the Soviet Union in the 1980s, if you live in a world where you know that everything is all a bit wrong and all a bit fake, and that when you get sacked from your nice job in the media, what you then go and do is take the payoff money and invest it in Airbnb, in flats that you can, apartments that you can rent on Airbnb, and that, and you're living off that, you know it's all a bit odd, but there isn't anything else. But underneath it, you know that you don't believe in anything, and you also know that the politicians who represent you don't believe in anything. What I found most sad, not just about the Hillary Clinton campaign, but also about when I watched the Occupy movement and I watched those meetings, they didn't believe in anything. They had no picture of a world they wanted to create. What they had of a picture was of a system of how to manage groups. Yeah? And they confused
That's true.
Process. They confused process with idealism. And that's also true of your second category of people who believe in algorithms as the solution to the future. Because what they say is, if only the system of delivery of information was efficient, then everything would be all right. What they ignore is they've got absolutely nothing to say in that system of information. Yeah?
Yeah, no, that's true.
Here's a picture of my dog yesterday looking a little more different from the day before.
Yeah, Occupy, it really did feel like they felt that just getting everybody together and having the discussion would at some point in the future lead to something. But like that's putting the way that collective organization and change happens exactly in the wrong direction. Like, you have to start from a premise.
Yes, you have to have an idea, and you have to inspire people, and you have to have something you imagine. What they've confused it. They became the very thing they were trying to fight against. Managers. That's what they were. They were like breakout groups in large corporate.
Trust falls.
and that was the real problem. And it is funny and it's absurd and it's silly, but it's also deeply tragic. And I think underneath it all is that both the left and the right, partly driven by Silicon Valley, but not completely, have bought into this utilitarian, rational mode of thinking, which is that everything can be measured, processed, and the outcomes can be predicted. It's a sort of managerial technocracy. And the left went for it because they ran out of ideas. The trouble is, it's a dead end. The way you change the world is by having a vision of a future. The last people who did it were actually Ronald Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher. They had a vision of the world. Their vision of a world was of a world in which politics would retreat. Great. But it was a vision. Since then, there hasn't been anything. And why it's so tragic about the left? I mean, in the film, I talk about Tahrir Square, which is a much even more dramatic example of Occupy, is you had this vast movement called out by social media. And social media is very good at organizing people. I mean, one mustn't knock it for that. It's really good at process. It's good at managing. And it managed to get everyone out there. They got to Tahrir Square. They toppled beautifully and brilliantly this vicious dictator had been supported by Britain and America for 30 years. And then they looked at each other and they thought, well, what do we do now? And none of them knew. And the one group that did have an idea, the Muslim Brotherhood, who are a nasty bunch of right-wing reactionary Islamists, swept into that vacuum and seized power. At which point, those liberal revolutionaries turned back to the generals and said, please, please get rid of these nasty Islamists. Okay, well, we'll go and shoot them. And really, literally, there were groups saying, yes, please do go shoot
Adam,
them.
I see shit from liberals in this country now who are doing the same. They're pining for a deep state coup against Donald Trump.
Yeah.
They're hoping that the CIA is going to overthrow him like it's Central America in the 80s or something.
They're not.
I swear to God, I've seen people maybe half kidding, but the thought is certainly there.
No, I've seen people say, like, very seriously, you know, patriotic people in our government need to realize the threat that Trump poses and stand up and show that they're really concerned about the Constitution by overthrowing the president.
Really?
Oh yeah. We have some particularly depraved liberals in this country.
Well, during the Sanders insurgency, there was a guy, Chuck Lane, who's the editorial page leader of the Washington Post, who was basically kind of craving a Pinochet to come along and take care of the Allende that was that was Bernie Sanders.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, it is funny and it's absurd, but there is also a serious thing behind all this, is that there is obviously a deep desire to actually make things better, and that over the last 30 years, certain very powerful groups in my country and in your country have effectively taken hold of power. I mean, above all finance, but increasingly that they're fusing with elements from the technocracy of Silicon Valley and of managerial systems.
I was going to say, I'm glad you brought up this idea that there is a very intense desire for change or for something different. And you talk about tragedy, and really all your films, you document this tragedy where people again and again, they want to get away from hierarchy, from power, from these old ways of domination and control. But they always invariably end up recreating the same thing over and over and over again. And you state that one of the features of living in a kind of post-political world is this failure of imagination to imagine a better world. So I guess in closing, how will we know, or is there a way of telling that, what would it look like to imagine a different world, I guess is what I'm asking. Do you have a vision of it? Or, I mean, not to put everything on you, Adam, please save us, but how would we know that we're beginning to imagine a different world, even within this hyper-real one?
You ask what real change might look like. And I think it's that is a really interesting question for liberals and radicals, because there is a hunger for change out there among millions of people who feel sort of insecure, uncertain about the future, and do want that to change. I think that change only comes through a big imaginative idea, the sort of picture of another kind of future, which connects with that fearfulness in the back of people's minds and offers them a release from it. That's the key thing. But I think the question for liberals and radicals is that they are always suspicious of big ideas. That's what lurks underneath the liberal mindset. And the reason is, and they're quite right in a way, is look what happened last time when millions of people got swept up in a big idea. Look at the last 100 years at what happened in Russia and then in Germany. The point is that change, political change, is frightening. It's scary. It's thrilling because it is dynamic and it's doing something to change the world. But it is scary because it can change things in ways where nothing is secure. It's like being in an earthquake. Even the solid ground underneath you begins to move and things dissolve that you think are solid and real. And I think that the question liberals and the left have to face at the moment is a really sort of difficult question, which is, do you really want change? Do you really want it? Because if you do, many of them might find themselves in a very uncertain world where they might lose all sorts of things. I mean, what we're talking about in many cases is people who are at the centre of society at the moment. They're not out of the margins. They would have a lot to lose from real political change because it really would change things in the structure of power. Or, and this is the brutal question, do you just want things to change a little bit? Do you just want the banks to be a little bit nicer, say? Or people to be a little more respectful of each other's identities? All of which is good. But basically, you carry on living in a nice world where you tinker with it. That's the key question. But you can't just sit there forever worrying about big ideas, because there are millions of people out there who do want change. And the key thing is, they feel they've got nothing to lose. You might have lots to lose, but they feel they've got absolutely nothing to lose. But at the moment, they're being led by the right. So things won't remain the same. But society may go off in ways that you really don't want. So in answer to your question, what you need is a powerful vision of the future with all its dangers. But it's also quite thrilling. It would be an escape from the staticness of the world that we have today. And to do that, you've got to engage with the giant forces of power that now run the world at the moment. You might, but the key thing is in confronting those powers and trying to transform the world, you might lose a lot. This is a sort of forgotten idea, is that actually you surrender yourself up to a big idea, and in the process you might lose something. But you'd actually gain in a bigger sense, because you'd change the world for the better. And I know it sounds soppy, but sort of this is the forgotten thing about politics, is that you give up some of your individualism to something bigger than yourself. You surrender yourself, and it's a lost idea. And I think, really, an answer to your question is, you can spot real change happening when you see people from the liberal middle classes beginning to give themselves up to something, surrender themselves for something bigger than themselves. And at the moment, there is nothing like that in the liberal imagination.
Okay, we are back. Hopefully after that, you haven't killed yourself. Like I said, we recorded this interview with Adam Curtis on Tuesday, but since then, I guess, like, the big news story that happened this week that we didn't talk to Adam about was this whole Russia hacked the election, right? Apparently, CIA assessment has concluded that Russia did intervene in the election. I personally do not know what the fuck to make of this. And the question I think that it should be asked is, what is being alleged here? Like, how did Russia actually intervene in this election?
The theory put forth is that they were involved in the DNC hack, which, by the way, basically comes down to the fact that John Podesta, who parenthetically is also the ringleader of an international child sex slavery ring, clicked on a phishing link on a random spam email and compromised his entire email system, which, not really the kind of OPSEC you'd expect from the Yellow King, but whatever.
Free Viagra pills in Carcosa.
Yeah, and he's like, ooh, click. So they got a hold of that information. They gave it to WikiLeaks. So basically, yeah, the theory is that – and this is based on a lot of spotty stuff, no real evidence, but I mean – maybe it happened or not. As they were saying, like, anybody who says, well, who's trying to play dumb, like, the Russians didn't want Trump to win, give me a fucking break. Of course they
Well, here's
Trump
the thing. Like, I don't, like I said, I don't know what to make of this. Like, I don't know what the fuck to believe. But the idea that Russia would try to intervene in our election or put the thumb on the scale to the extent that they can for Donald Trump doesn't seem totally implausible to me.
No.
Like, I can follow that.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's possible. But, like, what's weird is watching the liberal hyperventilation about it. Because on the one end, the most delusional end, the Peter Dow end, there are people who seem to think that this might lead to some electoral do-over or that it might get the electoral college to basically invalidate the outcome.
I mean, yeah, that's the wish, right, with all of this.
Yeah, that is the wish. And it's like, go for it. You know, I'm sure that those electors are glued to your Twitter feeds and they're really weighing these things because, of course, we're governed by norms. We're not governed by, you know, power-seeking interest groups. No, no. People are really governed by these ideas about what American democracy is. So they're really going to be persuaded by you going, this is terrifying, sir.
The line I keep hearing over and over again is that this is the biggest story since Watergate, and like right. Everyone should be talking about this nonstop, like every day, or else they're actively aiding and abetting. Actually, you know, Peter Dow had the best take on this. He was like, congratulations. If you thought Hillary was corrupt, bad, or disingenuous in any way, you played yourself. Russia played you. You're doing their work
that's
for them.
Like,
and it's like, dude, yeah, I didn't know Russia got her into politics like 30 years ago and like helped her create a fucking track record of awful, bad policies in politics.
Yeah, and the danger is that this is used now for the next 4 years to say, oh, we don't need to reexamine the Democratic Party. We don't need to rebuild the Democratic Party or bring in outside organization and pressure on it. We just need to make sure that the dang Ruskies stay out of our backyard, because besides that problem, everything is actually going
I think
fine.
That's exactly right. And that,
they,
that
yeah, they like, want to absolve Hillary.
Yeah, they like that. Like that's the there's people that are hoping to redo the election, which is like I understand that in a way.
Oh, sure.
But then I think there are people who are cynically using this to absolve themselves of like. Because we spent the last like 2 or 3 weeks, you know, talking about like the postmortem, like how did Hillary Clinton fuck this campaign up so badly? And now they're like spinning around like, oh, she didn't fuck it up, actually. That her strategy was correct. But it
well,
was,
there's
you know,
one thing that if you accept this premise, that there is one implicit criticism of Hillary within this argument that I would like to see these motherfuckers at least acknowledge. Because if a failing declining birth rate, plummeting currency, petro-oligarchy like Russia can sway the election of the president of the United States, then we have to at least accept that America is not already great. So, Hillary was wrong about that. She might not have been wrong about anything else, but she was sure as shit wrong about that.
Well, I mean, the other thread to pick up here, like if we are to believe that Russia was behind the leak of the DNC emails specifically, because the whole other thing with Hillary's emails is like the James Comey thing was about her mishandling of emails as Secretary of State,
Putin
which
didn't
is a
make
whole
her
other
do
thing.
Her own server.
But, like the other thing, like with the DNC email, okay, so like if that swung the election, what swung the election was just people finding out what Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party are actually like.
Right.
That's not a fucking ringing endorsement either.
No, yes, it's not as though like these hackers framed her up, like photoshopped Hillary into a photo with Vincent Gigante.
I think like a critical mass of voters in the Rust Belt found out that the Clinton campaign took seriously the work of Amanda Marcotte and Jim Beale Smith, and they were like, nah, not going to do it. I'm not just not voting. Fuck it.
Wait. Iglesias was on that call? Fuck them.
Like I said, this is just another weird thread in this kind of hyper-normalized environment where we're living in that Adam's talking about. This sense of kind of like vertigo where things keep happening and nobody knows what to make of it or what to do or how to change anything.
And everybody like is siloed in their own totally self-contained narrative loops that cannot interact and are totally incommensurate. And are perpetuated by boutique media consumption, and no social cohesion. Yeah, it's just everyone
except for us,
of course.
Yeah, obviously, except for this show,
we are the good ones.
Well, and yet another funny irony, and that we something that we brought up with Adam is now libs using this latest revelation to like exonerate or build up the fucking CIA. As some kind of like I read one article that was like it was just about how bad Donald Trump is, and it was like in italics it was like Donald is trying to say that the freaking Central Intelligence Agency is wrong ? Like Nancy Pelosi was like tweeting, he was like the CIA was right about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. It was the Bush administration that politicized their correct intelligence assessments.
Yeah, it wasn't like, George Tenet. George Tenet didn't say slam dunk. I believe that was Marv Albert. It was on the TV. There was a basketball game on.
Yeah, and I also have been seeing all these reactions, these like precious reactions from people saying, well, if the U.S. ever meddled in someone else's election, they deserve a do-over if that ever happened.
That motherfucker Robert Baer was on TV again, and he was again a couple months ago he was bragging about how he meddles in elections, and he was like, I'll tell you what folks, if we did this to any other country and they found out about it, they'd have another election
sure they would, yeah.
and they'd have another election, and then you'd like, you know, assassinate whoever they, they put in place.
Yeah he was about to say that part and you cut him off.
They'll do a do-over and Patrice Lumumba will be reelected.
and also now a lot of people, I mean many of whom are card-carrying liberals, getting defensive about the CIA and the integrity and the honesty of the CIA. It has spun them into this just now tangential defense of the entire American security state and empire. Like MSNBC's Joyanne Reed today was arguing with someone who said, well, what about when we invaded Libya destroyed that country 2 years ago. She goes, we didn't overthrow Gaddafi. Google the Arab Spring.
Jesus Christ.
We gave him
By the way,
help.
We didn't get a chance to talk about it with Adam, but one of the best threads in hypernormalization is about the colonel. The interview clips with Gaddafi are so fucking good. I mean, I wish he was still alive. And
I miss him.
I really do.
Yeah. And the real, and like, oh, people want to make this about the Russians. Yeah. If 15 ganky teenagers can overthrow your election results,
all wearing Adidas tracksuits, squatting.
You're a, yeah. They're like, somebody's got, they're injecting crocodile into their necks while like, Google, like emailing John Podesta, and they overturn your fucking election. Your country is a failed state.
Before we close out the show this week, I would like to do some plugging. Let's butt plug right now, because we got some I got some things here. I got some things I'd like to talk about. First
the
up,
parts.
Yeah, parts. Could we just go back to the parts? The parts. We just talk about the parts now. Is what I want to return to, as always. First up, on Wednesday, this upcoming week, if you are in Brooklyn or New York City, Katie Halper, she was our subscription guest this week, and my soon-to-be cousin through marriage. Actually, we are cousins and are getting married. At Brooklyn Commons this week, she's having a holiday karaoke party with the Katie Halper, brought to you by the Katie Halper Show. And I have promised to sing karaoke. So if you would like to come to that and never listen to music ever again after experiencing this, please do.
I will be there as well. I'll be in town for that. And they better have the Internationale. That's all I have to say.
We'll link to that Facebook event in the show info, right? And then finally, you know, one of the more cool developments now that I'm doing the show is that people send us books now. People send us books because, you know, they think it's something we'd like, or, you know, they want us to talk about it on the show. And Christ knows I have been on that side of things for a long time, trying to, you know, pitch books to people in the media or just get the word out about something worthwhile. And I actually have two books that fans of the show have sent us that I just like to shout out here because they're both quite excellent. The first of which is a book of photographs by Daniel Cronin called The Gathering of the Juggalos. And folks, truth in advertising, this book promises the gathering of the Juggalos, and that's exactly what it delivers. It is a book of photographs taken of Juggalos in their natural habitat at their gathering, and it is fantastic. It is really, really good. Matt, you got a copy of this too, right?
Yes, I did. I've looked through it. There's good stuff. It'll give you a nice understanding of a subculture that I genuinely believe is a prophylactic against Nazism among white working class.
And then last but not least, I want to shout out a graphic novel called Laid Waste by Julia Grafer. This is by Fantagraphics, and it's excellent. It's, how shall I describe it? It's a very, very dark sort of gothic fable about plague sweeping through a sort of medieval hamlet. And this this family, as they everyone around them succumbs to the Black Death. It is incredibly bleak and sort of metal, but also quite beautiful and moving. I really, really like this book. The art is great, and it's excellent. Laid Waste, out by Fantagraphics, by Julia Grafer. Available at fine bookstores everywhere. So that's it. That's it for this week's show. Everybody go out and buy those books. Everybody come out to the Katie Halper Show on Wednesday. And if you haven't already, watch all of Adam Curtis's movies to figure out just how the hell we ended up where we are right now. Till next time, guys.
Bye-bye.
Peace.
Bye-bye. Dream of a dream, dream of a dream, dream of a dream, dream of a dream, dream of a dream.
Attention, you are now entering the debarkation area. Orange Mind processing area. The next scheduled departure to the prison is in 2 hours. You now have the option to terminate and be cremated on the premises. If you elect this option, notify the duty sergeant in your processing area.
S.D. Plissken, American, Lieutenant, Special Forces Unit, Black Blight. Two Purple Hearts, Leningrad and Siberia. Youngest man to be decorated by the President. He robbed the Federal Reserve Depository. Life sentence, New York Maximum Security Penitentiary. I'm ready to kick your ass out of the world, war hero.
Who are you?
Hulk. Police Commissioner.
I'm Hulk.
Special Forces dream, Unit, baby, Texas Thunder. We heard a YouTube this morning.
Why are we talking?
Have a deal for you. You receive full pardon for every criminal action you committed in the United States. It was an accident. About an hour ago, a small jet went down inside New York City. The President was on board.
President of what?
That's not funny, Plissken. You go in. Find the President, bring him out in 24 hours, and you're a free man.
24 hours, huh?
Making you an old
bullshit.
Straight, just like I said. No time. Give me an answer.
Get a new President.
We're still at war, Plissken. You need him alive.
I don't give a fuck about your war. We're your President.
Is that your answer? Think hard. You flew the Gulfire of Leningrad. You know how to get in quiet. Lepka?
I guess I go in one way or the other. Doesn't mean shit to me. Give me the paper.
When you come in before. Told you I wasn't a fool.
Call me Snake.
We're inside the World Trade Center on the 50th floor. Just like Leningrad, Hauke.